Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, the Forum's own George Baggett will discuss his 45-year career in the environmental waste disposal business. Baggett describes the sketchy, rough-and-tumble world of toxic waste disposal before the Clean Water Act of 1972, and his efforts to make the city more transparent about toxic waste disposal, leading to a cleaner KC Metro. Baggett also details his famous run-in with two thugs in the dark of night and constant threatening phone calls he received following his appearance at a Verona, Missouri meeting to discuss dioxin, where representatives of Monsanto were present. This show was recorded on February 25th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show's format begins with our speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the forum committee. The forum's mission is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. I think we've been here for 70 years or something like that. 75 now. We have George Baggett, who is a longtime environmentalist in our area who had unique experience in the early days of hazardous waste disposal, which was even before I met him back in the 80s. And that's when disposal of hazardous waste was a free-for-all pretty much all over the country. And there were some famous instances that he will talk about. And so we're going to hear about how that whole thing developed and also even into the present. So I will hand it over to George Baggett.
Good morning. Until Trump and Pruitt, I had thought we were really heading in the right direction and continuing to do so. I don't know how to address that at this point. But anyway, when I was in college, I had a book. It was Perry's Chemical Engineering Handbook, and for disposal of most industrial acids, it recommended that diluting the acid with copious amounts of water was the way to solve that problem, and you could then flush it down the sewer. That was essentially the genesis of the phrase, "The solution to pollution is dilution." And then after working in the hazardous waste industry, being somewhat cynical about it, I came to believe that the solution to pollution was delusion. Hiding things, one of my former bosses, his favorite phrase, we'll close the barn door after the horses are gone. And so, anyway, I came from a family. Our family was members of the OWWC, the Ozark Wilderness Water Waste Club. We were a three canoe family, and every summer we would tour the rivers of southern Missouri and Arkansas and clean up along the way, pick up cans and whatever. I went to Vietnam in 1969. I was an Army medic, and I was concerned about the defoliants that were used there. And I think from a firsthand experience, it was just, I tried to find one of my pictures of just these muddy fields where it once was a jungle. So I came home very concerned about Agent Orange and the impact on all of us. After the Army, I received a Bachelor's of Science degree at UMKC in mathematics. And I met Norman Hersted about the same time. He was a family friend. He lived near my parents, and I knew his children. They were nice kids, and we got along. He was the owner of Conservation Chemical, a company with three facilities, one in Kansas City, Missouri, one in St. Louis, Missouri, one in Gary, Indiana, all involved in hazardous waste disposal and recovery of waste chemicals. I started having lunch with Norman, often expressing my concerns about environmental issues, including water contamination, air pollution, the fire on the Cuyahoga River that was rather spectacular at the time, just prior to this. And he kept telling me that I was naive about environmental issues. And he suggested he would become a mentor for me. And he thought of himself as somewhat of a guru. And if you look at these pictures, this is a black and white of the same river. The previous one was in color. But this is a rather spectacular fire in Cleveland. Anyway, so in 1974, Norman hired a 26-year-old nerd, which I was, with a scientific calculator on my belt. And during that time, there was a shortage of engineers. MU had a program where math and science majors could essentially work under training of engineers to become professional engineers and take a test or whatever. And so Norman was a PE, a chemical engineer from Rice University, and a really smart guy. And he became my instructor and my employer. At his office, he gave me technical books and bulletins to read. It gave me math problems and chemistry problems to solve. An example: he had tanker trucks that had he would haul chemicals in that had various specific gravity or bulk density, and so he needed a set of charts, one of an outage chart, a volume chart for these horizontal tanks, that for every inch it would tell you the volume, and then compare that to a specific gravity chart that would essentially ensure that your total bulk load was under the weight limits for the highways. And so that's what I did for all of his trailers at that time. I helped him install a wet lab where we were receiving samples of hazardous waste from all over the country. And then I was sent to St. Louis. And this is kind of hard to see. But this is the plant where they took pickle liquors from the Granite City Steel, and then they would put it in tanks, and then we would essentially add iron to the tanks, scrap iron from the next door facility, and then chlorinate that to ferric chloride or ferric sulfate and ferrous sulfate, and that was their main business there of recycling and selling pickle liquors or sewage coagulant chemicals to the sewer industries. This is an aerial photo of the facility in 1979. You notice it's right next to the Mississippi River. And all along the Mississippi River, there are what they call sinkholes, and within 300 or 400 yards of the river, and they're kind of connected. They're like U-tubes. And so there was a sinkhole right there. And that facility had a hose that went over to that that sinkhole through the plant. I discovered that while I was there, and he claimed that he didn't know about it. So I removed it. Then a few weeks later, I went back down there and found it was reinstalled. The tankers would come in, dump chemicals into a pit, and then that pit would miraculously empty overnight. And I became somewhat disillusioned with what was going on. You have to remember there, in 1972, the Clean Water Act became law of the land. And this was just 2 years before me working in this business. The goal of that act was to make the rivers fishable and swimmable. And it also introduced a program called the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System, MPDES, a permit system that started regulating point sources. Norman thought he had a grandfather right. He'd been in business since 59, and so he thought, but he was wrong, it turns out. While I was working there, the draft of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, RCRA, came out, and we were given copies of that. There was a time there was an EPA office at the TWA building downtown on Baltimore, And so I was picking up documents from them. They had this this in draft form, and so I wrote a comment about it. I was having kind of monitored a lot of activities at Conservation Chemical, but what I found was that there were companies that were that had leaking waste into the ground or behind their plants, and then they had a tank. They would put that in the, and put their some of their waste in and have Conservation Chemical pick up a load of this material once a year, and yet claim to any regulatory agency that Conservation Chemical was taking all of their waste, which was totally untrue. So I wrote a comment, and they recognized, and they also created a part of the RCRA law that was tracking a waste from the cradle to the grave, which we can talk about later maybe. The other mission of RCRA was to delineate and define sources for specific industries. And EPA was generating reports on all sorts of industries, from swim bicycle to the plating industry and the like. And these reports were readily available, and I started reading them. At the time, also, Norman was essentially sending me to waste disposal meetings, industry meetings, state meetings, all sorts of environmental meetings. And there's some kind of rumors or recollection maybe that the solid waste business was essentially connected to organized crime. Well, at some of these meetings, I realized that was very true. It just became obvious these mobster-type people were running the show all around the United States. I also accompanied Norman to meetings with EPA and then Missouri DNR as they became more and more interested in the disposal of industrial waste by Conservation Chemical. So this is a slide, a picture of 1979 aerial photo of the Kansas City plant that Norman had. And there's a levee road, and then you notice that the proximity of the river again. And if you notice that there's a roadway with direct access to the Missouri River. This plant was receiving waste up in here in the front from Armco Steel and others. They would neutralize them with caustics or lime, and then they would pour the salt sludge into these basins in the back of the plant. And that was the general theme of the plant. It was hard to believe to go visit that plant. I had some new leather wingtip shoes that I went walked out there one day and stepped in pools of mud that had orange-colored material in it. And what it was cyanide plating solutions, and it just ate up my shoes, you know. So it was really kind of a shocking experience. However, Norman also was aware that there were other facilities around the United States that were much worse than the one we worked at. He sent me to the CID landfill in Chicago, where chemical bulk trailers would come in and just pour hazardous materials right on top of the trash. I visited the Chain of Rocks landfill in Alton, Illinois. This was a landfill that seemed to never fill up, but it was located on an island in the middle of the Missouri River. And so you had to go across a bridge to get there. And it was run by a rather criminal element in St. Louis. I also visited a facility in Fenton, Missouri. And believe me, these are just a few examples of the hundreds and hundreds of these facilities throughout the United States. A farmer had essentially developed a technique of having a drill that would drill into the soil, big, like 6 feet in diameter, and drill 20 or 30 feet down, and he would fill up this clay soil with hazardous materials. It's like a honeycomb of hazardous waste. I always had kind of a mixed feeling of working for Conservation Chemical. It was like there were the facilities around the country were significantly worse, and yet Conservation Chemical was trying to treat waste. You know, it was like they may have been lacking in their capabilities or their skill techniques or their equipment, but they at least tried. But if you can see this, I don't know if you can tell what this is. This This is the Valley of the Drums near Louisville, Kentucky. And they see the rows of materials there. This is a closer up picture of the Valley of the Drums, where there was all sorts of plating waste and painting waste and chromium and PCBs and dioxins and all sorts of stuff in that facility. And they had, it was owned by a 90-year-old man. And this company came in there and they buried drums on top. They dug trenches 10, 20 feet deep, and then they buried drums in there, and then they capped it, and then put more drums on top and kept piling it up. And it was rather the people that visited this place, when they it was kind of out of the way, so when they found, this made Conservation Chemical look like a place that you could have breakfast on the landfill. You know, it was another facility that comes to mind for me, and believe me, I'm just limiting it to a few because I know the stories. This one, the Chem Control Facility in Elizabeth City, New Jersey. In the 80s, I met an EPA guy that was stationed at this facility before the fire. They had found this facility filled with drums, 35,000 drums of hazardous waste from around the New York area. And they, while he was working, there was radioactive waste, there was everything. Anyway, while he was sitting in a trailer outside there guarding this facility that had been abandoned by a criminal element group of people, a helicopter flew overhead and dropped a bomb on this building. And it blew up, and you could see it. You could see the fire for miles away, and even in New York City. And so, and it burned on. There was PCBs, and this is also a dioxin site because of the products of the combustion or incomplete combustion. So my thinking was that Conservation Chemical of Kansas City, Missouri, and St. Louis. They at least attempted to recycle a portion of the waste. They attempted to neutralize and create insoluble salts, by mixing acids and bases together. That treatment technology is actually currently the basis of most wastewater treatment plants, of precipitating metals and neutralizing waste acids to make salts that are somewhat insoluble and non-hazardous. The Kansas City facility was also located north of the Blue River, next behind the Hawthorne Power Plant, and next to the old Kansas City landfill, and behind Bayer Chemical. So it was actually in a remote area, not exposing people to this environment that much. But Norman had his faults, but he had the chemistry correct. The problem was that it had taken place before the environmentals came to play. And the most serious problem he had was he was overwhelmed by customers who considered reducing their waste they generated or using less hazardous materials was a waste of time. They weren't interested in that topic. I was fired from Conservation Chemical, I think it was in 1976. I worked there 2.5 years, I think. And I mainly because I had kind of lost faith in the ability of the company and the owner to comply with the laws. And after I told him this, I read the laws and said that I didn't think it was possible for him to comply unless he just stopped taking waste from other companies. And so I was escorted to the door, and that was my last days of Conservation Chemical. He knew everybody in town and all the big businesses in town. And so I was looking for a job, and I heard that he was telling people that he was teaching me a lesson, that I would soon be back to working for him. At the time, I actually felt somewhat relieved, and my father was incredibly relieved. I viewed Conservation Chemical similar to my experience in Vietnam. I learned a lot from both, but I didn't want to repeat either one of them. I still had construction tools from my time before I went to college, and when I actually painted the house at Dr. Bragg's house out on Cherry. I was up there on the ladders when a guy in a white hat from Armco showed up in the driveway. My wife had told him where I was, and he wanted me to come off the ladder and talk to him. I also received a call from the manager of the Colgate-Palmolive plant, which I was surprised, too. The Armco facility, they were wanting me to build another hazardous waste disposal site similar to Conservation Chemical, but trying to comply with the laws. And my response was, my father never raised me to be own a dump. I politely refused, but I kept telling him, anybody who would listen to me, that you should build your own wastewater treatment plant. Colgate-Palmolive, on the other hand, they'd been contacting Conservation Chemical and me during that time, and they had a byproduct acid from, I don't know if you can see this. This is on the left is a hot long chain vegetable oil hydrocarbon, and then if you add oleum to it, it generates a soap base, but also generates concentrated sulfuric acid as a byproduct. Well, Armco Steel and wire rope and other steel industries were using concentrated sulfuric acid to clean steel. And so I approached them, again, telling them they should build their own wastewater plants. And lo and behold, Armco started buying acid from me, and I was pretty pleased. I bought a truck, tanker. I built a small tanker out of stainless steel that would haul concentrated sulfuric, and I started personally hauling concentrated sulfuric acid to eight truckloads a week to Armco Steel, and which was probably the hardest job I ever had in my life. I also sold the same acid to a couple of galvanizing plants in the area. Meeting with Wire Rope, though, and Wire Rope Corporation in St. Joe, They didn't want to buy this acid, but they didn't use that much. But I went to lunch with them and made a sketch of a wastewater treatment plant that they, on a legal pad, you know, and they decided that they would build it, and if I would help them find lime for it or inexpensive base to treat the waste materials. Well. This is basically the chemistry equation for making acetylene gas. As you use calcium carbide that's manufactured in Louisville, Kentucky, and you mix water with it. And this is a picture of calcium carbide. It's little rocks. They when you put it in water, it fizzes like Alka-Seltzer, and the gas that comes off is acetylene gas. The other byproduct is calcium hydroxide and water in a slurry format, liquid format. And so here was lime available, and they had plenty of lime outside their plant, and they had tried to put it in a sewer and plugged up a sewer a mile long at Puritan Bennett Corporation in St. Joe, or Elwood, Kansas. So, and this is kind of, I don't think you're going to see that, but this is the lime cycle. As my wife and others to say, I know more about lime than most people want to hear. This is essentially the nature of lime and how it's made and how it's produced in its cycle, returning back to calcium oxide. And then off to the right is the chemistry of neutralizing waste acids with lime. So, and it seemed to be that, so I built, while I was delivering acid to Armco, at night and on the weekends and whenever I had time. I was working 60 hours a week doing that. I also built this plant up in Elwood, Kansas to recover the lime from the plant. And this is a picture of me sluicing lime under I built a geodesic dome for a variety of reasons, but that's me sluicing lime in this pit and then putting it in. And this is, in fact, you see, look at the difference in this pond. There's lime in the base of that pond, and then here's after about a couple of years later how much I'd taken out. This is a serious amount of material left at that facility. So I started delivering lime to the plant. This is the tankage and the equipment that I had, and there's my little tiny truck over there on the bottom. that I used for hauling lime that I had been using for hauling sulfuric acid. And so then I upgraded. And so I was able to deliver lime to not only Wire Rope, but they had a facility in Chillicothe, Missouri. I delivered lime to the GM Leeds plant until it closed. I delivered lime to the Kansas City DOE facility, and I sold lime to Hercules out of DeSoto. And so I was still working my tail off doing all this. And then Armco graciously shut down their plant. Thus began some of the issues with conservation chemical and disposal of waste. And since they shut that plant down, Colgate Palmolive was in big trouble. I was selling acid over there and having a transport company handle it. And they immediately gave us very short notice to shut that down. So I had been thinking about it all the time, and I went with them up to DeSoto to the sulfuric acid plant, the oleum facility. They're run by USI, and convinced them they could essentially take that waste sulfuric acid, burn it in their furnace with the elemental sulfur, and make new oleum so they could have a closed-loop system. And it worked. So Colgate-Palmolive was fixed, and I was a hero at Colgate-Palmolive for a while. But, you don't make a lot of money doing that. So about the same time that Armco closed, that's when Conservation Chemical in Missouri became known to a lot of folks, and primarily the Missouri DNR and EPA. It was also about the same time that Tynes Beach and the dioxin disposal on the roads and the horse arenas became news. My friend Karen McCarthy, a state representative and neighbor, asked me if I knew anything about dioxins, and I'd attended the World Conference on Dioxins. She had me testify kind of secretly down in Verona, Missouri. And the man from Monsanto was there, and he was pretty freaked out by my testimony. But, you always make friends when you have to. As I stated, it started to heat up. The conservation chemical had buried lots of waste over there at their site. And this became kind of a serious issue when the EPA asked me to come over to their offices and tell them what I knew over in Kansas City, Kansas. But they'd moved over there then. And so I sat down with them and told them a little bit. I really was not necessarily in total loop, but I knew quite a bit. And so then suddenly I was being subpoenaed to being deposed by attorneys for representing some 300 companies that were involved in that were generators of the waste that went to that facility. And so I went to this deposition thinking it was going to be a kind of a casual affair. I was mistaken. I soon realized that my integrity was also being questioned as well, and there were documents that made it look like I might be responsible for some of the things that had happened at Conservation Chemical. And it was kind of a bit of an attempt at framing me, but it didn't work. It was a silly effort. Anyway, I became pretty much of a popular guy with EPA because I was their guy, their witness. But that wasn't necessarily the case with all the people that were responsible parties. I started getting threatening phone calls, and one night after testifying, two guys were waiting for me at my home and chased me up my driveway. Some may recall, if you were here for Chet McLaughlin's talk, he mentioned this. His memory is slightly different than mine, but I was experiencing the thing. Some may recall, if you were here for Chet McLaughlin's talk, he mentioned this. His memory is slightly different than mine, but I was experiencing the thing. I had gotten chased out of my driveway by these two thugs, and then I went in and I had called my friend Marcia Dickinson, who worked at EPA. I just told her. She was my friend. I talked to her almost every day. And then she told Chet, and then the following morning, a car was out in front of my house with an FBI agent, and asked him what he was there for, and he told me that the EPA was concerned about my safety. And so they stayed there for about a week, and then my deposition was over, and a bunch of it seemed to die down. Nobody, I wasn't getting any more threatening calls. And then suddenly, until a few weeks, a few months later, I guess I was testifying against the hazardous waste incinerator and started getting them again, and they returned. So anyway, since the time of working in the, I had essentially gone from, after Armco quit, I was only working 1 or 2 days a week. So I was doing environmental activism with Craig and others, and I wrote a paper called The Basic Chemistry of Dioxins and Furans. If you look at the bottom, the 2378 TCD, the dioxin on the bottom, that was the isomer of dioxin that was intentionally manufactured through by Monsanto and was a component of Agent Orange. The one on the right is a very similar compound, 2378 dibenzofuran, that is a similar compound, and it's a product of combustion. And so what I found in this research was that the 2378 was the most toxic, but the isomers that were found in the adipose tissue survey were all over the board. There were 74 different isomers, and they were found in tissues. So basically, the source of those dioxins had to be combustion. And so that was not real popular with the incinerator industry, but, you know, you make good friends. I became a member of the Chamber of Commerce and helped arrange a meeting with when Wheelabrator came here to build a hazardous or a solid waste incinerator. I had him meet Craig Vollen at that one of those meetings, and we recall this meeting with great fondness. They never knew what hit them. I was the program chairman of the Air and Waste Management Association in Kansas City, and I wrote papers like this dioxin paper. Elliot Berkeley and I became friends, and he arranged a meeting for me in Chicago to meet with the Great Lakes Commission and at the consulate in Canada. And I gave them Craig's paper on mercury emissions from solid waste incinerators. A few weeks later, I received this CD in the mail. I had to go buy a CD player. At the time, I didn't know what a CD player was, but it was a data bank of almost all of the chemicals, thousands and thousands of chemicals, exposure limits and stories of being exposed and like. And so then with this information, I started the newsletter. If you recall, I was in the news a little bit from activism, and that I started a newsletter called The Toxic News. And that newsletter, here's a copy. It's just a two-page copy, and I had a toxin of the week. And I was actually picking the list of the air pollutants in Kansas City, the primary air pollutants that were in the toxic release inventory that were out. As a result, Mayor Cleaver at the time appointed me to the Air Toxics Commission, and I had done some stories with the local TV folks to showing the sources of pollution and air toxic in the city. And Craig and I both traveled around the country fighting garbage incinerators and hazardous waste incinerators and the like. But everything was going along just fine until the flood of 1993. I was amazed that, and this is a little bit ahead of time here, I was amazed that my plant was underwater in Elwood, Kansas for 2 weeks. And Union Carbide, who then had bought the facility, they decided to close that plant. And due to concern of flood waters coming in contact with calcium carbide, and which was really a rational decision. And so, but I had 5 years left on my contract, so they kept supplying me lime out of a plant out of Carter Lake, Iowa. In short order, it made no sense for me to have them bring lime to me in a tanker, unload it at my facility, and me load it back up in my truck and send it over to the companies that I was selling it to. So I graciously just sold them everything I had going in a flood is the best way to go out of business, by the way. So I sold my customer list to them, and then Craig and I started an environmental consulting firm together. And this is a picture of the B-1 bomber plant in Burbank, California. And we went there, and we were hired by the city to evaluate the Superfund disposal site, our Superfund site, of the cleanup of this facility. They had truckloads of documents. When we went there, this is the B-1 bomber plant, and they had bulldozed this as one big empty lot. And the primary problem was that there were chlorinated solvents in the ground, in the soil around the facility that needed to be cleaned up. And they were proposing various techniques, including a vapor extraction system for the facility. So we evaluated that. We evaluated some of the risk assessments, recommended some changes to their plan for handling some of the materials and, in fact, re-injecting air that they collected rather than discharging it in the environment. And, of course, the Lockheed guys were really thrilled by our event, our being there. We handled a public hearing, Craig and I were just talking about, it was televised in the L.A. area. It lasted for like 2 or 3 hours. It was a long, long day. We took questions from the audience for hours. But I think we did a fairly good job. Well, returning from California here, I was kind of, everything was new. I was not sure what I was going to do. Our consulting firm had some capabilities, but we weren't sure. So I learned that Praxair was really looking for me. Praxair was the Linde division of Union Carbide. And so my lime customers were not thrilled by how they were receiving lime from Praxair. But what was more important, the management at Praxair found out I was selling lime for about $1,500 a truckload, where they were paying $1,500 a truckload to get rid of it at 26 facilities around the United States and Canada, which made them real interested in talking to me. And so I became their lime guy, George Baggett, lime guy at Praxair. And I'm standing on a pond of lime up in Duluth, Missouri, Duluth, Minnesota, with some lime in my hands. And I set up an ag program up there. And we had 120,000 tons of lime in this pond, and there were like 30 of them. I was actually called to the offices in Danbury, Connecticut, Union Carbide offices. They had first talked about me handling lime from their facilities, and yet they thought that when I went into their main headquarters, they acquainted me with a few other problems that they had that they hadn't told me about. So in this time since 1993, I've built this is a facility I designed and built at Fresno, California, to recover lime from the acetylene plant in Fresno. I built 10 of these facilities. We closed down 16 facilities. And then not only was I helping to find customers that we wouldn't make a mess in lime business, but this is a 3D design that I just got through doing here in Taft, Louisiana, and this is the tankage. This is the drawing, and this is how it started looking when they started building it. And it was nice to have plenty of money working for a big corporation to do everything that I wanted to do. Anyway, that was one of the parts of this, is find a way to keep it from becoming a mess. And then this is the final product. You see the stainless steel piping and high-quality valves. This is a pretty expensive facility. But here's a picture, aerial photo of one of the lime ponds that I cleaned up. This is it would be a picture from about 1994 or so of a facility in downtown Duluth, Minnesota. And you can see there were rows. We dug some trenches to see how deep it was, and I removed 120,000 tons of lime from that facility. And this over a fairly good sized place. If you look, just think of the size of that, if you can kind of visualize it. And we excavated it out and sold it to farmers in the region for ag lime because of the acid deposition on the soils up there. And the we also found a few things in, while we were digging holes. And so these are old buried acetylene cylinders. We found like 13,000 of these things. And so, but this is what the site looks like after I cleaned it up and we capped it and put a seal on it. And then there was a creek by it and put riprap along the creek. And that's what it looked like today. So that's all I had to say.
Great.
And he started out with his mathematics degree from UMKC. And then all that happened and went from one to the other. That's a fascinating history of his work life.
Referring to the current state of affairs nationally, is it possible to take an entire agency that has a mission and, like, take it apart or destruct it so that it doesn't do what it's supposed to be doing? And I don't know, how much time would it take to do that? Is it possible to do it, or are the laws, like, really supreme over each individual agency?
In my view, there's two answers to that question in a way. The laws were built with a time frame and implementation, and to get rid of them by just summarily saying we're not going to do this, we're going to get rid of that law, is not all that easy to do. The second part is the enforcement. If you don't enforce a law, or if you make a proclamation you're going to let coal ash be dumped in the rivers, there's nothing. That's rather immediate. This is something that's happening now. So, as I tell the attorneys in our company that I'm still working for, I don't really think it's wise for any of the industries to disregard the environmental laws that were on the books as prior to Trump and Pruitt. I think that this is a temporary reprieve and foolish driven, as we see with the coal industry, and this industry is going to go away. The nuclear power industry is going to go away just because of all the problems they've had. And so they're really working hard to destroy it. But I have faith that we will turn it around. At least I hope we do. But, Ginsburg, or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, said that the two things in the world or the history of the United States is the pendulum swings. And now that it's gone this way, it'll swing back the other way, my thinking.
I, too, am more interested in the political implications than anything else. But for us less scientific types, I have a very basic question. Lime, good or bad?
Well, if you've been able to see the small print on my little diagram, lime is essentially made from calcium oxide, or calcium carbonate, actually. And so you excavate calcium carbonate, which is limestone, and you burn it, and you burn off, and you make CO2 as an emission. And then the off product is calcium oxide, and then it becomes calcium hydroxide if you add moisture to it. In the acetylene industry, they buy calcium carbide that takes high-quality, high-purity Mississippi lime from southern Missouri down to Louisiana, and they burn it in an electric arc furnace, but they mix it with this carbon. And at 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit, that material becomes molten calcium carbide. It kind of looks like steel, actually. And they pour it into ingots. And they let it cool and break it up and size it. Well, for distribution to the acetylene industry, at that temperature, the toxic organics that we're of concern, most incinerators burn them at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit and say they're destroyed. Well, this material stays way above 2,000 degrees for hours, and there's no toxic organics in it. There are the heavy metals that were in the carbon source, are also vapors at those temperatures. So they become pollutants and ash at that facility, but they don't remain in the calcium carbide. And so I have repeatedly tested lime throughout the United States and Canada and found no heavy metals and no organic compounds. And it's real. It has a gray color from iron, that the iron oxide that's in there from the electrodes. So there's a little bit of iron, and there's a little bit of aluminum in it. But neither of those are toxic to the environment. So I proved to many people that this was not hazardous material. So is that good enough?
Yeah. Now let's get to something really toxic. How about nuclear and the Atomic Energy Commission and all this, where in Missouri we've had a mess, in Cincinnati we've had a mess, but do you have anything else to say, and how can we do anything about that?
Thank you, Lon. We planned this question. I wrote a paper, I wrote an article for Z Magazine years back called Down Along the Savannah River. And that was about the Savannah River complex. The Hanford, I've been a student of the Hanford facility cleanup for a long time, and I've been following DOT. I actually visited the uranium hexafluoride plant in Paducah, Kentucky years back, and saw some of the contamination, results of the contamination down there, exposed people and the like who were drinking groundwater with radioactive materials in it. My thinking about nuclear power is that they just aren't looking back up the line where the rods are manufactured and how it's put together. And that I've always often said that for Korea, North Korea, and Iran, we should invite them to come to America, their representatives, and give them a tour of the Hanford facility, give them a tour of the Savannah River facility where the tritium reactor was, and just show them the ramifications of this extended period of radioactive materials being played with in the United States. I would hope that we could discourage them from further action. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, sir, and how you doing? And thanks for today. I wanted to ask about the cleanup. Like you said, how long does it take to clean up? Like right now at the Bannister complex they're talking about building, and the 31st Street, the contamination down there, and they said in other spots throughout Kansas City. How long does it take to clean it up before you build, and hopefully it won't affect people, you know, with cancer or something like that? Thank you.
My answer to that is there's no one size that fits all. That the DOE facility had some PCBs, and they cleaned those up and hauled those away. When Brent went to an incinerator, there's still traces. The heavy metal content of some of these facilities, you have to diagnose it. You have to look at the solubility of it. In fact, my thought is that each facility requires a facility assessment that will tell you how effective you could be with a cleanup. But I'm also a believer that some facilities we have to recognize are never going to be cleaned up to a satisfaction of what we would think is a clean environment. I think they're what we call sacrifice zones. They're just too damn complicated to clean up. So it takes forever, especially radioactive materials like a Fukushima. You know, it's still going on, you know, the event there. And these are the reasons that I think nuclear power is on its way out, just because it's not going to be economical to continue to do it. Yes, sir.
Take you back a long way, George. When you were working back in the mid-70s, when the EPA just first came into existence, you and I started our careers about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever run into a case? Did you ever experience anybody hauling material and just dumping it on a road?
Well, yeah, that was the Times Beach issue. A trucker was hauling waste off from Monsanto and other places, and using it as an oily material for dust control in Times Beach, and putting it on arenas for horse arenas, and horses were dying. That was pretty common practice, and so and part of it is, my benefit of having Norman as a mentor in a way, But he understood organic chemistry, and he taught me. In fact, I didn't know that. My degree in mathematics was, I didn't know, I had some chemistry, but I didn't have that much. So I met Delta Geyer. Some of you remember him from our church. He was a PhD chemist that taught chemistry at the Chiropractic College. And so two nights a week, my daughter and I would run over to his house, and he would have me read a book. He was getting textbooks we were reading. And so we read textbooks and commented on textbooks that he had given, were given to him. And he taught me applied chemistry better than anyone I could have had in a college. So what I'm saying is that there were two types of companies. There were scientifically oriented companies, and we were sort of. And then, there were bulldozer operators that looked at oil and said, "That's came out of my crankcase," you know. But all oil is not the same, and the chlorinated compounds made a big difference in how oil is perceived. Yes, ma'am.
So what you said earlier about the solution to pollution is delusion, I find to be very true. I'm starting my career in an engineering field and seeing that all over the place. And I think something that I've noticed especially is that we're moving these things away from the United States, and we're sort of offloading the responsibility for the pollution onto other countries. And especially noticing the construction of sort of coal-fired plants and natural gas plants and manufacturing facilities in places like China, Vietnam, Indonesia, India. I wonder what lessons can these countries learn from our mistakes, and what drivers do you think need to be in place for more responsible behavior moving forward?
For another lecture, I do believe we've made some serious mistakes. When I attended a conference at UMKC a long time ago, where the premier of China was here, and I asked the question, which was not a very popular question, was what steps, as they develop their industrialization of their country, are they taking that would prevent them from screwing up their environment like we have? And the latter part of that is that we've already screwed up our environment. And so he misunderstood the question, actually. This question in Thailand, get caught dumping waste, you'll lose your life. It's becoming known, but and look at the plastic disposal in the ocean. I mean, we have some seriously complex problems. Although I have to tell you, compared to what it was like when I first started in the 70s, the air is cleaner. You know, we embarrassed most of the industries in Kansas City by the air toxics program, and I helped the local news outlets understand what they were looking at. So it is better, but you're right. That was one of the things about the maquiladoras facilities too. They were full of contaminants, and they were not having to dispose of them properly, and so they moved them into the Mexico area, and those same plants would not be able to operate in the United States, at least not then. Now with Pruitt, who knows?
Actually, I have a real quick question. Could you take just a minute or two and talk about the role of citizen activists in the solution of this pollution problem over the years, like Lois Gibbs and some of the early pioneers?
I didn't mention all. He's so tall. I didn't mention that Craig and I got to know a lot of environmental activists in the United States. We were called to a Blue Mountain conference up in New York one time and met people from the National Toxics Campaign and Greenpeace. And in fact, we got involved with them a great deal. Citizen action, including Lois Gibbs, one of my favorite people. She was a lady that was just typical housewife from Love Canal, and she was not typical at all. This citizen activism really did change the direction of so many things. in Kansas, if you notice, in some of the parts of the United States, some of the industrial areas, they had solid waste incinerators. We call them garbage incinerators. They refer to them as waste energy facilities. I refer to them as waste of energy facilities. But we don't have one in Kansas City. And Craig and I and some others really prevented that from happening here. And KCP&L was big on it and others. So citizen activism does work, especially, in fact, when I met William O. Douglas when I was a kid, we were on a canoe trip on the Buffalo River, and one of the things he said to a group of young people was that conservation is really a good thing, but we're going to need technically conversant people, was I think his term, that are going to be familiar with chemistry and physics and mathematics and the like to be able to discuss this topic. So citizen activism is great, but you also need somebody who understands the chemistry and the techniques and what they're looking at. And that's one of the big downfalls of citizen activists is that they don't want that toxin on their cereal in the morning, but they're really not sure what it is. So, yes, ma'am.
George, what's a quick answer or a quick statement when you run upon someone that is so far right, they want to do away with the EPA, they want to do away with any regulations? How do you counteract kinds of statements?
I have a real quick response. There's just some people you cannot argue with. And so you're wasting your time. My favorite saying is I'm pushing a rope. Thank you for listening. I enjoyed giving this to you today.
Great. Thank you.
George, to add to your huge collection, here's another one. Our forum mugs, U.S. Union-made forum mugs. And he'll be available for further discussion in the library. And next week, you can kind of throw your cares away. It's going to be totally frivolous. It will be the 90th Academy Awards with Robert Butler, and he will give his annual prediction on who's going to win. And so that'll be all fun.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Early Days of Hazardous Waste Disposal with George Baggett. This program was recorded on Sunday, February 25th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.